Welcome to the World Cup preview episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Tad.
Welcome to the podcast with all the excitement of a 50-over game and without the tedious middle overs.
Well, there's none of that tedium when Canada are playing.
No, as they've shown today. They showed so excitingly, so thrillingly today. For those of you who were looking forward to Toby doing the opening line, as promised, as audio recorded for the last episode.
I'm saving myself.
He's failed and he's dropped short.
I'm saving myself.
We are getting very excited about the World Cup, despite the rather horrible format. And what we're going to do is we're going to plow through all the teams involved. We're going to try to give ourselves something of a challenge here. We are, after all, dealing with a limited overs format, and we're going to go for limited seconds. Limited seconds. We're going to go 90 seconds each for all the big teams, and then be a little bit dismissive about the minnows.
In another 90 seconds.
In another 90 seconds. So, let's...
Do you want to kick us off in Group A?
It would seem logical to start with Group A.
Right, you've got 90 seconds going from now.
Right, let's start with the Sri Lankans. I've described them as a mix of the sublime and the mediocre, including those who were sublime and have become a little mediocre. A little bit harsh about Murali, but no one can really see him having a tournament like he did in the Caribbean. And Mendes is the mystery spinner who's not that much of a mystery anymore.
So who are the people who are the sublime of these?
We're thinking sublime. We're thinking Sangakkara, Jayawardene, Dilshan. They're very much Sri Lanka's holy trinity. Could be their final tournament. Lots of experience in the conditions. Sangakkara, Dilshan having a great 2011.
Are you a bit worried that the team's a bit dependent on them?
They might well be. You get the feeling, if you're the opposition and you can knock over two of those quickly, you get Dilshan quickly, you get Sangakkara quickly, you get onto a middle order that looks distinctly mediocre. You've got Sam Awira, who's done it in the test game, not really in the ODI format. Matthews is exciting, but maybe not consistent.
You do, but you would hope that the big three are going to come up with the goods the majority of the time for Sri Lanka.
They are,
as they have done so often.
They're great players, and we'd expect a great tournament. And there's no question, 33, they're all 33, 34-ish. Probably their final tournament, home conditions. It's a great opportunity for them. But I do just wonder, they're certainly going to fail on a couple of occasions, and we'll see if the middle order can deliver. And that's almost perfectly 90 seconds.
Sublime.
Sublime, indeed. So,
next up, talking about sublime and ridiculous, we're going to go on to Australia, 90 seconds starting now. For a team who have been richly humiliated in the Ashes, they've done well. The world bounced back in a series of one days. A lot of pundits have struggled to find any real meaning within. There's a question of whether it's just a bit of an Ashes, post-Ashes backlash, their huge victory over England.
I suppose the question of how long that backlash goes.
Exactly.
Can it continue
into the World Cup? But the World Cup is a very, you know, different and draining format, as it were. So we'll see what goes on there.
In terms of backlash, Ponting of all the players there. If someone's going to have a backlash after a tournament like that, after an Ashes like that, even
it will be him. There was a question though in the One Day series against England about how much cutting edge they had in the bowling. Doug Bollinger was the only person to take four wickets in an innings, which over seven tests is very telling.
It is, but I do like Brett Lee at present. He's bowling with menace, he's got a bit of experience, and I think he could play a role for them.
Yeah, they can, absolutely, but I wonder whether they've got a real unit who would be
able to keep it up. And can we squeeze in a mention for?
For Mr. Shane Watson, perhaps the best one-day batsman in the world at the moment.
Quite possibly the man at the moment.
A nation's hopes rest on him, and I think if he fires, Australia will be a force to contend with.
It would have surprised if we'd said that a while ago, that he would be going into this tournament as the key man. So,
next up, New
90
Zealand.
Seconds now on New Zealand. I reckon you could make a case that of all the teams, they go into this tournament the most out of sorts. A horrible 2010. Somehow contrived to lose 9 ODI games, all 9 they played on the subcontinent last year, including 4 against Bangladesh. So, a horrible year. They've got a top four in their batting order that really should pack a punch. I mean, you've got Ryder, Taylor, Guptill, McCullum, players who can get going, but that never really do.
And actually, they're a bit like Scotland in the Rugby World Cup, in that they put in
the Scottish cricket.
they put in usually quite good performances actually in the World Cup.
They do. A great record in the World Cup. Well, a great record of nearly doing something in the World Cup.
But I didn't think any of us really expected them to win.
We've got used to the idea that they are something of a one-man team. Vettori will be huge for them, both with bat and ball. I've picked Nathan McCullum as really a key man to look for them. Very useful late order hitting of late. And on these subcontinent pitches, is his spin good enough to back Vettori up? Because Vettori will bring them 10 overs of control. If McCullum can bring them another 10, they might just do something. But I've also mentioned very briefly Aurum and Styris. Veterans, been there, maybe not done that, but certainly done something. And they certainly bring experience to the format. We'll see what kind of tournament they have.
And you do wonder whether New Zealand cricket is going to go into a bit of a free fall if they fail
to reach the quarterfinals. This could be huge for a game that is very much in decline in New Zealand as it is. Well, just about squeezed that one in.
Talking of poor preparation, surely no team has had actually worse preparation than Pakistan, who probably haven't seen a net or a changing room for the last 6 months. So embroiled have they been in court cases and chatting about who the next captain is going to be.
They have been busy playing in New Zealand. Let's give them that.
They have. But in terms of team bonding and real preparation, you wonder how much has.
No, they've had their minds on.
Gone in. It's an interesting situation for their one day side because they've got four or five really key players: Shoaib Akhtar, Yunus Khan, Abdulrazak Musbah Al-Haq, who are sort of in their early 30s and for whom this might be the last World Cup.
They do have depth, though, don't they? I mean, that seam attack, despite losing Asif and Amir, it still looks quite lively.
They do have depth. But what I wonder is, over the prolonged format that a World Cup is, whether they've actually got players who are either going to be reliable or who are going to be game-changing on a regular basis.
And we've talked about how journalists always, mercurial is the word used to describe Pakistan.
But it's absolutely true.
Absolutely true. Yep. But maybe, if they come good at the right moments.
But the problem is that in order to get through to the semis, they're going to have to beat three out of four of Australia, Sri Lanka, India and South Africa.
A challenge, yeah.
Which is going to be really, really
We expect
tricky.
Entertainment at the very least.
They rarely fail
to provide that.
And where we will certainly get entertainment is with the small fry of Group A, Zimbabwe, Kenya and Canada.
Well, Zimbabwe are probably the biggest of the small fry in that group. There's a real buzz about the game in Zimbabwe at the moment. Their showing's improved a bit internationally. Their domestic game's even got quite exciting. Brian Lara has been playing out there recently. I really like their prospects, actually, here. I think they've got a really exciting spin trio. Ray Price, Prosperous there. Got a huge amount of experience between
them. And particularly
them.
On the subcontinent, that's
And
gonna,
Graham
that's
Cream as well. Handy. Maybe not in their league, but a very, very talented youngster. I think they'll cause teams problems.
Okay.
Batsmen probably won't deliver enough runs to keep it interesting, but we'll see.
We've seen another minnow causing a big side problems today. Canada giving England a bit of a shock, mostly thanks to Chima's 93 from 70.
And he's rather built his own expectations up, hasn't he, now for this tournament?
He has, well, exactly. And actually, the team have come out and said that they're going to reach the quarterfinals, which seems bold, particularly having promoted five under-19s into their squad. You can guarantee that their matches are going to be entertaining. Of course, they were infamously bowled out for 36 against Sri Lanka.
Entertaining/brutal.
Well, exactly. There are going to be runs and wickets. Whether it's for them or against them is another question.
Finally, we have the Kenyans, who, after their 2003 World Cup heroics, I mean, they were the next big thing that never were. Made the semi-finals, have gone nowhere since. Arrived in India for a bit of pre-tournament preparation to get battered by a host of regional youth sides,
yep.
Which kind of done great things for their confidence. I think, sadly, the worst indictment of the side is that 39-year-old ex-star player Steve Ticklow has been kept on and coaxed into another tournament and finds himself pretty much key to both their batting and even their bowling prospects.
The domestic game in Kenya hasn't been bringing on the...
No, it's a slightly sad story, and there's probably someone we can blame for that, but I'm not entirely sure who.
Well, that was positively 2020 pace. That was rapid. Serie A rapidly canter through the nations onto Group B and start off with England, who, having engineered an operation of military precision to win the Ashes, look once again in absolutely shambolic disarray going into this World Cup. It's something that World Cups seem to bring out of England. Losing Collingwood in form and Morgan entirely will be a huge blow to the middle order, and therefore England's ability to go on and post and chase significant totals.
I did mention last week whether this Aussie, the problems in this Aussie ODI series hadn't been slightly overplayed. I really feel like, compared to recent World Cups, England don't... I mean, disarray, I wonder if it's not too strong. Like, but this England team looked better, a hell of a lot better than the team that went to West Indies a few years ago.
Can it be good for morale being beaten so thoroughly in a one-day series so close to the World Cup? And B, what I actually wrote down yesterday and was proved rather nicely today is that England's bowling looks very susceptible against the kind of gung-ho, all-guns-blazing batting attack.
Which we will see a lot of in India.
Exactly.
I do think it'll be interesting. I think the loss of Morgan is huge. Given that we know that Andrew Strauss has this podcast on repeat in the team dressing room, what would your prediction be for him?
Well, I think that England are going to be involved in a little bit of a tussle in Group B. If they get beaten by Bangladesh, then they're going to be, you know, it's going to be very tricky down the bottom of the basement.
Yeah.
So I think they need to put in a number of sustained performances and frankly, I would question their ability to go too far in this tournament.
Oh, well, so plenty of pessimism. India. I'm going to go a little bit against the received wisdom, which has this tournament as being wide, wide, wide open, and actually suggest India are the clear favourites for this. They look to me the best equipped side to go on and win it. I think pound for pound, they've clearly got the strongest batting lineup. We're not just talking Sehwag and Tendulkar, but some of the youngsters who are coming through. Virat Kohli looks outstanding, and his form's a real plus for them. I mean, I was reminded today, I've kind of forgot about Dhoni. He's a player that's almost kind of blended into the wallpaper, but today he made a cracking innings in the warm-up game against New Zealand. I feel there's a confidence to the side that's not always been there. I think they feel this is their time, and I think there's an awful lot of belief in this Indian squad.
And they've got a squad that's obviously very suited to the conditions that are going to be where the World Cup is.
Well, exactly.
That's an eloquent thing I've ever said.
And particularly with the ball, where, you know, we know it's difficult to bowl in these conditions. Probably no seamer does it as well as Zaheer Khan. Harbhajan will be key with the ball.
Harbhajan, exactly. And talking of Harbhajan, the next team... South Africa, one of the things they're going to struggle with actually is the lack of a really good attacking spinner. Johan Botha is probably likely to start most of the matches, I think, and I think the role he's going to play is going to be important.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting for South Africa approaching this tournament in the subcontinent without a sort of out-and-out, real-class attacking spinner. But they're another team. I mean, talking about India feeling like it's their time. You know, maybe Graham Smith's last as captain. This South African squad, always the case of getting close.
Any team that's got Smith, Callis and Steyn in it is going to be a force to contend with, because of those three, and then you add some others.
He was doing all sorts of damage to the Aussie top order the other day in the war. He looks the scariest bowler in the tournament.
Yep.
And if he can consistently get into teams early on, then you feel they've got a good chance.
There is still this question about whether they choke, and they did in the middle of it. You know, it wasn't even in a World Cup, it was in the middle of a series against India, where they put in a couple of pretty horrible performances.
The choking question just never goes away for them.
They never make it go away. They always set themselves up for those kind of things. Now, talking of chokers, well, I don't think the next team are really going to be in a position to be choking.
Well, that was a rather brutal start to our preview of the West Indies, who are my improbable dark horses.
Yeah, but they're always your improbable dark horses.
It's good to have Toby here for so many reasons, but one of which is to counter my irrational enthusiasm for West Indian cricket. But they have been on a horrible run.
I would have understood it 20 years ago. But
they've been on a horrible run. In ODIs, they've not beaten a test ODI side for 18 months, which is pretty awful. But I think things are coming rather good for them. You've got the arrival of two genuine batting prodigies in Adrian Bharath and Darren Brava, who both look the part and could have a very exciting tournament. And you can't help feeling, as a pair of all-rounders, I would think any team in this tournament would want to get hold of Dwayne Bravo and Kieran Pollard. They can bowl for the format, they are brutal hitters when it comes to it, and they have been key players in the IPL. You know, they know India. They've played there. They've played the conditions. I mean, Pollard made his name there. You know, Pollard's hitting in India is what's made his career.
And actually, for Chanderpool, there's a question of this is probably his last World Cup, and he's a quality player, and it'll be interesting to see.
And for a player of his class, I mean, he'd love to sign out with something. You know, his career has been so often, he is the definition of sort of struggling in a hopeless cause. I mean, how he would love to be part of something a little bit bigger. My final thing in the West Indies is just for years and years, there's, well, not years and years, but recent times, real sense of inferiority. And if they can just go for it, a little bit of a sort of carefree, nothing to lose spirit, I think they could be a real dangerous side in this tournament. And if they get off to a good start, get a bit of momentum.
Now, there's a question as to how we've divided the big guns and the minis in this group, because actually we put Bangladesh into the minis, and indeed Ireland into the minis. He did better than both the West Indies and Bangladesh at the last World Cup. But anyway, we have decided that all three of the Netherlands, Bangladesh and Ireland are
minnows.
Minnows. And
we'll kick us off with the big minnow, Bangladesh, the test-sized minnow.
The test-sized minnow. We've got two bowlers in the ICC's top five, that's Abdul Razak and Shakib Al-Hassan, which either confirms all you need to know about the ICC ranking system, or it actually indicates that Bangladesh are a pretty handy force to be reckoned with. And when you think that Tamim Iqbal is in there as well, and Mortaza.
I mean, Iqbal has the potential to get them off to some very exciting starts. Whether the rest of them keep it up is quite another question.
That's the problem. There's a good five there. It's the rest of the squad that's just the problem. And as we said, they don't actually need to do all that much to get through to the quarterfinals.
It's an interesting format, isn't it?
A shock win against England or against the West Indies.
They beat the other minnows and they beat the West Indies or England, and exactly, suddenly they find themselves in the quarterfinals.
But they have got the mice of the Netherlands standing in there.
Mice of the Netherlands. We're now assaulted on either side, as you might hear, by ambulances, police cars,
and doorbells.
I can assure you that there's nothing going on here to merit their rapid arrival. The Netherlands, well, frankly, of all the minnows, I think they're most in danger of perhaps utter humiliation. I reckon any hope they have of doing anything exciting will rely on Essex's Ryan Tendershardy. He scores quickly, he's exciting, and he can do something with the ball. I think the tournament's most brutal massacre, if that's your thing, if you like watching a bunch of amateur cricketers get hammered by an international side. I think India will do something horrible to the Netherlands in their group game, and I fear for Holland's bowlers, but we shall see.
And completing the group is Ireland, who pulled off some famous wins at the last World Cup against Pakistan, the Windies, and Bangladesh. I have to say that actually nowadays they look a little bit like a kind of county side, actually, more than they ever have. And some of the heroes of yon, Porterfield, Johnson, Rankin, and Niall O'Brien, are still there, but I don't expect them really to
don't expect miracles to do much this time. I mean, Ed Joyce, of all the players, got such a point to prove. And that game when they play England, I mean, talk about some grudge of a cause. I mean, he's definitely a player with class, but it will be tough for them. I think beating Bangladesh in a series that, in a competition, let's remember, they've got the advantage of their own home conditions as well. I think it will make life very difficult for Ireland.
Well, they'll be slow and steady rather than spectacular, and I don't think that's going to win the race on this occasion.
And that is the World Cup in about 15 minutes.
Well, if only the ICC could learn something.
If only the ICC
do the whole thing in that length.
England, New Zealand.
The 314th test ever played.
Good.
At Headingley. This test is, well, the reason I chose it was twofold. It was the debut of Trevor Bailey, now sadly passed in the last week, and because it was a pretty remarkable test match, actually. It was a three-day match, and it was the first of a four-match series. And just to give a little bit of context to New Zealand as a world force. Actually, they didn't win for a test away from home until 1969, 30 years later. And they didn't actually win against England until 1986. And actually, I think you have quite an interesting stat about...
There's a cracking stat that I've semi-forgotten, but Bangladesh have currently played... If you look at the number of games Bangladesh have currently played, it's about 67, 68, and after that same number of games, New Zealand had won three test matches, which is exactly the same as Bangladesh. Mm. So when we have a go at Bangladesh today as sort of not a proper test side, New Zealand have very much been there, done there.
Frankly, New Zealand don't look like a proper test side.
Well, yeah, we won't say that.
So But the point about this match from way back in 1949 is it could all have been very, very different. As I say, it's a Headingley, it's Trevor Bailey's first match, and New Zealand field a pretty batsman heavy side, so getting England out for 372 in the first innings is a bit of a bonus. Even though two of the New Zealand bowlers take all 10 wickets between them for 200. England, though, do get a bit of an advantage on first innings with a 30-run lead after Alec Bedser holds up an end is a bit harsh because his sort of probing cutters go unrewarded, but they pile on the pressure so that Trevor Bailey on his debut can come in with his customary pace and bounce and take 6 for 118. England then go out again, they sort of seem to decide to make a bit of a game of it. And the captain, George Mann, makes a quickfire 40 and adds that to
Sir Washbrook's century. Pretty bold for the time as well.
He does.
But I suppose there's an expectation it's New Zealand, who were the Bangladesh of the 40s. And
exactly,
you're sort of thinking they need to get the win.
So England declare and leave New Zealand to get 299 off 2.5 hours. This is a 3-day test. And you think that it's kind of game over. But actually what happens is that New Zealand come out and they play with a kind of remarkably gung-ho approach. And at the close, they're 195 for 2 or 49 overs. They're only 100 behind. And they've got one batsman who's 54 not out from 50 minutes. And it's just this sudden question of if there had been one other session or if, you know, things had gone slightly different.
And I suppose, whether
actually this might have been...
You know, we love looking at sort of the long-term consequences of these games. And you imagine they get that first win. Big win at Headingley, sets them up for the series as well. You know, what the sort of the kick up the behind that could have given New Zealand cricket generally, just to the
Because if they had won that, it would almost certainly have been that would have been the series, because it was that they were 3-day matches and all of the other
these 3-day matches are sort of disparaging England, don't really think you're worthy kind of thing.
I wondered that, because of course Australia always had this attitude towards New Zealand that they would always only play them in a three test series, and I wonder whether it was the same thing, but I don't actually know what the historical fact is, isn't it?
But I think in terms of you can't imagine going home as a spectator that evening thinking, God, we needed a finish to this. They've clearly rushed and sort of very much abbreviated the finish.
So there was this brief moment then in Headingley in 1949 when New Zealand cricket might well have taken a different course. We'll be looking at Gideon Hayes' collection of essays, Inside Out. This being a slight relief after the trauma of last week when we saw a cricketer who wasn't really a writer trying to be a writer. Gideon Hay isn't a cricketer by his own admission. He's a pretty
cricketer, but a pretty poor one. Yeah.
But one thing he certainly is a stunning writer, and anyone who hasn't read him really should rush to a bookshop.
Widely become accepted, he is the cricket writer at the moment. He's going to be perhaps the writer who, when looking back, he will be seen as our generation.
Absolutely, and I think the main reason for that is, and this is going to make me look horribly ignorant, because I can't remember the exact quotation of C.R.R. James, when he talks about those who, you know, knowing more about cricket, who not only cricket know, and actually...
What do those of cricket know who only cricket know, I think? Horribly overquoted that, but so horribly overquoted that I can't remember it.
Yeah, well, exactly. We'll blame it on the overquoting.
We'll blame it on the...
But Gideon Hay does have a remarkably wide and lucid ability to range over different topics and different contexts.
No better example of that than in his wonderful essay on the art of leaving a cricket ball, titled Fabian Batsmanship. In an extraordinary single page, he links the art of leaving a cricket ball to the Roman general Fabian, who, for those of you who may be less classically educated than Gideon Hay, stopped Hannibal from taking Rome through what was described as masterly inactivity. He then links it to the Cold War, and he does it in a way that isn't token. He talks about how the Cold War, detente within the Cold War, was never truly about stillness. It was always about constant recalibrations on both sides. And he links this into the way when you leave a cricket ball, something changes in the relationship between batsman and bowler. And you're reading this and you are agreeing with him with every word. And at the same time, you're thinking of something that you've never really thought before. And frankly, there's not really a higher compliment you can give to most forms of writing. Aside from that, I like the fact, I've chosen two essays by him, the essay on the leave and the essay on taking guard. I love the fact that he is brilliantly nerdily technical. There are far too few cricket writers who actually get down to the nuts and bolts of the game. Too many talking generalities and stuff. He knows how the game works, the actual fundamental nuts and bolts of it. He talks as well in terms of taking guard. There's a fascinating piece talking about the various merits of taking centre. Taking a leg guard, all these making the comparison. I particularly enjoyed the fact, sort of Barry Richards' view, that you can't take two legs. You've got to take one or the other. You've got to be bold. You either take middle or you take leg stump to allow yourself to play. You know, this may even change the way I play. I'm considering taking a leg guard for next time to bring out my exotic offside strokes. And finally, a sort of wonderful reference to the way that actually the process of taking guard, all that sort of ludicrous hammering and chiselling we do when we come to the crease, that he says, a crucial way of a cricketer sort of calming and composing himself. Again, something that maybe strikes you as very true when you've said it, but you haven't heard it said before. And perhaps, again, that's Hayes' genius.
Well, actually, there's... It's Chanderpaul, isn't it, who nails a bail into the ground when he comes to the comes to the crease.
Well, Chanderpaul's normally there to stay, isn't he? He's kind of settling down.
Well, there is, but also that's very much an identity thing because that was part of I can't remember which island it is he comes from, but it's something that they all do to say you know, it's like because the pitches are so hard they all have to do it, and it's sort of become originally practical, but it's sort of become his identity.
Become a routine, and I like the idea he references particularly to 150 Derek Randall once made at Sydney, talking about how Randall described himself. He said it was a key part of him composing him for that innings. Flashing very quickly back to the leave essay, I like the fact he said that actually in this age where batsmen are supposed to go for it consistently, you know, perhaps the art of the leave is sometimes being lost. You know, batsmen feel a compulsion. If they're not playing shots, they're not doing their job. Yep. We all know, as cricket nerds who are quite content to watch someone, you know, leave, or perhaps not leave every ball of a day, but leave an awful lot. You know, it's part of the genius of the game. And I think, you know, it's Hayes' ability to understand that. You were going to take it on to maybe Hayes' grumpy old man side?
Yeah, which is actually what I share.
What you share in common with
him. Certainly don't share his lucidity or his capacity to write beautiful prose, but what I do share is his profound distrust of 2020 cricket. And there are a couple of essays, one after the other in this book. The first one, which is called Variety Show, which talks about the fact that actually 2020, as we now see it, aren't the first time that variations of the game have sprung up, and that actually it's been happening fairly consistently for a while. And it's interesting, a game that's often seen
as about tradition, isn't it? The idea that actually he's again showing his wonderful historical knowledge of the game, showing that it's always been about innovation.
Yep, exactly. And there are some great examples, such as the man with his dog who goes out and plays single wicket matches against you know all the heroes and beats them. So there's that quite
nice. I think that merits an entire podcast, that story. I'm upset by the fact we passed over that in 5 seconds.
Next week. He then goes on to talk about 2020 itself, and there are these couple of sentences which I just have to read.
These are truly merited for a reading.
Because these are very fine indeed. He says, the format, that is, of 2020s, originated on the marketing whiteboards at the England and Wales Cricket Board 4 years ago as a means of attracting cricket tolerators. Sports watchers, averse to the game, who might consider going if it was shorter, sharper and noisier. A novel idea, this, to redesign a game to the specifications of those who don't like it, rather like creating art for consumers who prefer pornography, or composing music for listeners with a taste for cacophony. And actually put like that, what he does is he summarises in a nutshell what is so futile about 2020, which is exactly that.
Those who don't want to go,
changing the game for those who don't like it.
And I think perhaps the essays we've chosen, I think, as well as showing Hayes' extraordinary frame of reference, his incredible turn of phrase, it's also the fact that he's able to talk just as well on the nitty-gritty of the game and to understand sort of the big changes as well. You know, he's as happy talking about how you take guard as he is about talking about massive changes within the structure of the game. I mean, no writer at present has his sort of confidence over that scheme.
And it's thoroughly recommended.
Well, I don't think you can recommend him highly enough. I think you have to read everything. I think you have to read everything he writes. to feel that you're truly on top of the game. And it's hard to disagree with him on very much. And yep. I think,
and he's got a blog on Crick Info and writes for that. I don't know if he still writes.
He doesn't
the Guardian.
Write nearly enough. Would be my one thing on Crick Info. Yep. I think he's got the stage where he's very much a quality, not quantity man. And I'm distressed by how rarely he updates
stuff. He's just produced a
Sphere of Influence.
Crick, and its discontents, which is ludicrously expensive on Amazon, which is why we're not reviewing it today.
we're all about quality, but yeah, not exactly. If it comes at the cost. Right, finally for the debate, we have a topic for which Toby has promised to get hot under the collar, so that's something to look forward to.
Well, I'm hoping we're actually going to disagree.
Quite seriously,
this time.
We have a genuine, we have a genuine disagreement on this. Did Butt, Amir, and Asif get what they deserved? Who's going to get angry first?
I think I'm going to get angry first.
Good.
We're both going to say, I think, no, they didn't get what they deserved, but I think we're both going to go in different directions with that, and I'm going to say that actually, I think it would have been quite fair if all three of them were banned for life. I think what is quite dangerous about... There's been a lot of backlash that says with Amir, you know, he's young, he's gullible.
I think you are backed, and I would agree with you, you are backed by the majority. I would say there are a lot of people who are gunning for the life bans. What I would say is there has to be an understanding. You say, oh, he's young, he's gullible. He was a 17-year-old when he came into squad, a 17-year-old from a poor Pakistani background. Now, I'm very aware that you get to a certain age where you're legally responsible for your actions, etc., etc., but I cannot believe that there weren't other people involved in the management there. Yeah. It should surely have been their role to protect him.
I mean, he is a teenager
from a very difficult background.
And I agree absolutely as well that... The whole thing is bigger than the individual. It's not his fault entirely, and it is a cultural thing. And that the more the game has become soaked in money as it has over the last 10 years, the more the attraction is going to be. But as soon as you use that to excuse the individual and say, oh, the individual is subject to all of these things, and therefore the individual doesn't have to answer for his own actions. And I mean, I'm sort of taking on huge great issues of morality and philosophy here. But I think it's particularly the case here. As soon as you say to cricketers, well, you exist within this world, therefore you can be excused for falling from it.
I am not, frankly, I'm not entirely anti his 5-year punishment. I think you are right to the extent that if it had been much less than that, you'd be sending out an interesting message. What I hope we can maybe agree on is that I find it ludicrous that we have a teenager being hung up. And, you know, I'm going to leave Butt and Asif personally. I think they got what they deserved. And I think, frankly, they could have got more. I think Asif's record in terms of previous bans for drugs, but apparently it was being investigated a long time ago about this. I think they are dubious characters. I think there's a record to suggest that. I just think with Amir, it would be ludicrous if a teenager gets a ban for this and no one in the Pakistani management is nailed for this.
Yeah, but
I can't believe
there's
someone who can't go down with him in terms of someone whose duty it was to protect him.
But you're saying that Butt and Asif, you think they look like dubious characters. Therefore, they should have got...
Do you know what? I said dubious, and I felt this sounds a little bit unfair.
Trial by whispered jury that I think has done the whole thing.
I think
the fact is that Amir took an individual decision to do something which he knew was putting commercial interests ahead of the fact that he was, you know, playing for somebody. And you know, yes, you say he was young, but also at the age of 17, this sounds horribly pontificating, but if I was playing for England, I think the first thing in my mind would be the fact that I was playing for England, not, you know.
Yeah, it is obviously a tragedy that never happened, that the 17-year-old chap was never given an opportunity. But my other feeling with Amir in particular is that you have someone who, huge amount of ability, it would be a tragedy to see it lost, but also, more than that, that you've got a cricketer who, how much choice he had is interesting. Like this Majid fellow, who I think we could agree on the subject of dubious character. Well, he's a shady figure. Can we have that as a given? Like, I mean, on the News of the World, that little camera, he looked pretty much the definite. Anyone who stands in front of a suitcase full of money tends to look shady.
Alan Stanford.
Well, yeah, we've learned. Cricket really should have learned by now. And we have this idea that he was calling Amir up in the middle of the night, bullying him, harassing him. I mean, I just wonder whether there was clearly choice, but he was clearly pressured into this. I mean, my only feeling is there has to be other people taking responsibility. There's people in the management for whom a teenager like Amir had to be protected, had to be looked after.
But that's a separate issue. It's a separate issue whether it's not either Amir gets punished or someone else. I agree that there is something systemic in the game, and perhaps particularly in Pakistan it has been said by some, but that it doesn't excuse Amir for his part in it. And I think simply because other people haven't been punished, I don't think Amir should, by default Amir should not.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I'd like to think, I'm hopeful that Amir will have the opportunity to rebuild his career, which I think I think not everyone does agree with. I think there are some people who think you should never have that opportunity. The other thing that I'll say is a little bit controversial here, but I'll say it anyway. Spot fixing is not match fixing. There is a difference between throwing the result of a game, consciously losing a test match, and agreeing to bowl a no ball on demand. Now, it's not desirable, but we have to see there's a difference. No one has raised any question that Mohammed Amir, for the vast majority, was busting a gut in that series and bowled some stunning spells.
I agree entirely, but I don't think you can ever say, for the sake of that, there's such a difference between them that you can sort of turn a blind eye to spot.
No, I'm certainly not.
Because as soon as you open up cricket to any kind of
manipulation
in that way, then I think it's very
I think frankly we all just found I found it slightly astonishing at the time that you could bet on which ball of an over and no ball. I mean, I think that was something that we all found frankly astonishing. So I think the argument we there was certainly a, I don't know if we were hot under the collar, but there was certainly
a bit of gusto,
we'll see. I think there's a lot to run on this. We've got a criminal investigation coming up in the UK, and we'll see how that pans out. Thank you for putting up with us again, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time to talk about all things World Cup, how our predictions have gone hideously wrong, how Netherlands are marching imperiously towards their first World Cup final, and we hope you'll join us then.